she does.
Welcome. So glad to have you guys here. I have a little bit of dinner on my shirt, so stand here and go like this. But it does say women support women. So it is my honor, my privilege to get to introduce you to Kelly Kay, who's going to share her story. I have the privilege and honor of working with Kelly in this program, and she has been a gift to me for the many years that we have worked together. And I know that her story will be a gift to you guys tonight. Kelly will share with you that part of her journey, or actually her journey, began in the womb and continues on to today. And it's a very, what I call, brutal story. There is some brutal aspects of it, but what she has managed to accomplish today is absolutely beautiful. And so I invite her to come up now and share her story with you.
That's my sponsor, and I said I probably should have called her before I stepped up here today. I know better. And I'm feeling it right now, so just bear with me, and we'll get through this together. That's the gift of the program, actually, that I have been given, is the fact that I know I'm not alone any longer, and I know I'm not the first person that's told their story that felt like they were just a bundle of nerves inside. And that's okay, because I look out in this room and I see so many familiar faces that have become more than friends. You guys have become family to me. And as you hear my story, you'll know why that's really important to me. So because this is the Happy Destiny meeting, I'm going to pull out the third step prayer from the AA book. And start with that. So for me, God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self-will, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Thank you. Thank you for being with me. Okay, so, and then I'm going to switch gears and I'm going to go to How Al-Anon Works, because this is my favorite piece of literature. And I'm going to read something that that just always hits home for me. It says, in Al-Anon, we eventually come to see that many ways we had unknowingly blocked out whole segments of our past and present. We recognize situations in which we had unconsciously convinced ourselves that what we saw happening simply wasn't so. At the same time, we understand that we were doing the best we could at the time, trying to survive, to adapt to the way our lives were affected by alcoholism before we found the help of Al-Anon. And for me, the journey does start in the womb. I was born to an 18-year-old young lady who had a drinking problem. And I learned at age 10 that I was the product of a one-night stand. And this is after many, 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 many lies about who my father actually was. I was told that my dad and my mom were married, and he was killed in a car accident on the way to the hospital while I was being born. So I took that on as a little girl, thinking that my daddy died because of me. And I built him up on this, like, huge pedestal, like this fantasy pedestal, who my dad was. He was this hero that was rushing to the hospital to see his baby girl being born. And then at the age of 10, my mom and my stepdad took me outside and showed me a birth certificate. And on the birth certificate, it says, under father, it says none. And I was 10. So I'm like, well, that's because he died and I hadn't actually been birthed yet, you know, and I'm still trying to rationalize it. But the reality was, she met my dad at a college party, a frat party, And she met him that one night, and she slept with him, and I was created, and that's the last she saw of him. So I don't even know today that he even knows I exist. And I don't know that he doesn't. So the reality for me was what that did to me as a 10-year-old is it just rocked me to my core. I had no idea who I was. The girl that I thought I was, I wasn't. My last name wasn't my last name. It was actually my mother's maiden name. I had been told my whole life that was a coincidence. And, you know, to this day, I've never met another person by the last name of Fritsch ever that spelled my way, not the way Tony Fritsch spells his name. And so I know today that that's a little far-fetched, but then I didn't know better. And so when my mom became pregnant with me, she was living with my grandmother, and my grandmother, who I call Nanny, was the most incredible woman that I had ever known in my entire life. And she and I bonded. My mom was out drinking and partying a lot, even after I was born. So she, in fact, my sister and I are 11 months apart. So my mother had another baby. Just a couple months after I was born, she got pregnant again by a father who's not in the picture either. And I would learn at the age of 14 that I had a sister that I didn't know about my whole life. Although I felt somewhere inside that I always had a sister, I had this imaginary play sister that I played with all the time. And so somewhere intuitively I knew, or maybe I heard as a toddler, you know, overheard a conversation, I don't know. But my mother was very, very, very drunk one night, and she was sitting in the living room just sobbing. This is not long after I took the pills out of her hand that she was about to try to commit suicide with. And so as a 14-year-old, I flushed those pills down the toilet and sat there and took care of my mom all night while she told me the story of my sister's birth and subsequent the plan she made for adoption for her. And that night something changed in me, because now I don't know who my dad is, who I thought I did. I found out that I have a sister that I never knew I had. So my identity and my family of origin never looked the same again. I then later learned that I had a grandfather that was still living that I had never been allowed to see. That grandfather, I was again in fantasy land and determined that I was going to start super sleuthing and find him, because I wanted a grandpa. I didn't have a father, mind you, a legal father, so I was going to find my grandpa. And this was going to be fantastic. It was going to be wonderful, and it was going to be this journey, and I was going to find him, and he was going to love me. And then I found out that he held my mother and my grandmother hostage, and there was a SWAT standoff, and that he used to wake her up and stomp on her goldfish and be standing there with a shotgun and telling her and my grandmother that he could have, just laughing maniacally, he could have killed them while they were sleeping. And that's why I wasn't allowed to see them. But that didn't stop me from seeking this man out, because no matter what you could have told me about him, I didn't want to believe it. I just wanted a male in my life that would love me. And maybe this man, who I had never met, maybe he'd love me. So I kept trying to find him. And we didn't have internet back then. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have car phones. We didn't have any of that. So I'm digging through phone books, and I'm calling anybody that has a name that's remotely spelled like mine. And I found him. And so my mother, after I begged and pleaded with her, decided it would be a good idea to send me by myself to spend time with my grandfather, because she couldn't handle it. So she sent me with my baby brother to go spend time with my grandfather. I would love to say that it was a happily ever after, It was probably one of the weirdest visits I think I've ever had with someone. But I was able to meet him, and that was one moment in my life that didn't end up in a huge catastrophe. But it still was scarring because there wasn't that. Number one, my mother, as I grew older, I realized what she had done. She sent me alone with my baby brother, who was 7 years younger than me, to a man's house that had held her hostage at gunpoint. And I actually became very resentful to her for not protecting me and putting me in a position that she had no idea. She hadn't seen him in decades. But because I begged, pleaded, borrowed, and stole, lied, super sleuthed my way into it, I got my way. And that's where my Al-Anonisms really began, was in that super sleuthing, that manipulating, that twisting the truth, that begging, pleading, saying it just one more way to get my way. So when that worked, I saw him, and there was no real connection, and it wasn't the fantasy that I thought it would be. And we went and we did some things, and then it was nothing. And so I started looking for love in the faces of other men. And this is a pattern that I would repeat repeatedly for decades. And it started likely back when I was a toddler, until about four. I lived with my grandmother, as I mentioned, and my mother. And about 4 years old, my mother married my stepfather. I met him, and they married. That's my memory. I don't know for a fact that's how it happened, but that's my memory of it. They got married in a bar. And so I have pictures of me in a little dress and in a bar, standing there as the flower girl. And the next thing I know, it felt like to me as a little 4.5-year-old that my mom introduced me to this man. She married him the next day, and we moved in the next day together. I don't know and don't really believe that's how it happened, but that's my memory of it as a 4.5-year-old. And she's not here to ask anymore. So that's all I've got to go on. That was my experience. So that day I was taken from my grandmother's safety, the one place that I could land and feel safe and secure, and the one person I had actually bonded with. She was like my mother, and I was pulled from her and put in this new home, and I was expected to know the rules, and I didn't know the rules. And I was experiencing night terrors. I was having extreme nightmares that were very realistic. So I believe there was things under my bed, like a lot of little kids do. And it was in those moments that I would get up in the middle of the night, and I'd go into my mom and dad's room, and I would beg and plead for them to let me get in their bed. Just please, please let me be with you, because I was terrified. And they wouldn't allow me to. They would send me back to the place that I was terrified of. And I'm a parent. I get it. I mean, I did similar things with my kids. You're wanting to help them learn to be independent. But at that time, I wasn't the parent. I was the 4.5-year-old that was terrified. And to me, that was the worst thing on the planet you could have done, was send me back there with the monsters. So I would crawl in, and I would sleep on the floor like a dog, next to the underneath of their bed, which was terrifying. But I do that because in that moment I learned I got to choose my hell. I would either stay in the hell that was near my parents, or I would go to the hell all by myself. I'm choosing this hell. And that's where that pattern of choosing, you know, you've got two choices. One's really bad and the other's really worse. And that's where I learned to do that. And it was just those types of things that kept reinforcing my thinking. It kept reinforcing the choices and the decisions that I would make for the rest of my life. And so many of these things that now that I've worked through the steps and I've done the hard, laborious work of step work with my sponsor and sitting in meetings and feeling the uncomfortableness of not doing what I really feel I should be doing, you know, I've learned these things that to many people outside these rooms would be like, well, that was just a four-year-old girl who was having nightmares. Of course you don't let them crawl in her bed. If you let them crawl in your bed, then they're going to keep crawling in your bed, and you're never going to get them out of your bed, and then you da-da-da-da-da-da. But to a four-and-a-half-year-old that was experiencing night terrors, that really, truly, firmly believed something was grabbing my hand as my arm dangled off the side of the bed, that was the most horrific experience. And having to leave the comfort of the one person who I felt safety with and not have her in my life, not be able to reach out or go to her and just be sent back. It was torture. It was really hard. And so we'll fast forward a little bit. I called my first stepfather, my dad. It's probably going to get a little confusing because there's a couple of them in here. But he's not my biological father, although he is my father to me. And he might as well be my biological father. I remember sitting at a restaurant when I was about five. They had been married. We had just done our first move, our first geographical relocation, about 6 months after they got married. And he was sitting there with some friends, and one of the men at the table said, you know, Richard, she looks so much like you, she could be your daughter. And he slams his fist down, and he's like, that is my daughter. Don't you ever say anything different. Of course she looks like me. And he stood up for me. I had this man in my life that stood up and took ownership of me. And I remember what that felt. I'll never forget what that felt like. And the decades of pain that would come later, that one moment was worth it for me. That one moment. So when we moved to Surfside, my mom and dad were well into their party phase. My mom had been doing it since before I was born. And they left me with babysitters a lot. And so one of the times they left me with a babysitter, I was kidnapped. And it was while being kidnapped that they gave me something that would make me pass out. And then they would use smelling salts from a first aid kit to wake me up as a five-year-old little girl. They thought it was funny. And I can remember being at the party, and there's just all this drinking and drugging going on around me, and just wanting to go home, just wanting to be with my mom and my dad. And then I remember being taken in a car from this location to that location. And again, I'm five, so I don't know exactly what length of time I had been kidnapped for. I do know that the sheriff's department, a lot of different, like, emergency responders had been called out. They were dragging the beach. We lived a couple of blocks from the beach. There were spotlights everywhere. There were lights everywhere when they finally did get me home. But I don't know if it was a day or if it was 2 days or if it was overnight. I couldn't tell you that. I was too young to remember. But that was one of my first experiences of what happens to a child when the parents are not present. And then what happened right after that would be that the next 2 years, they would leave me to my own devices, and they would send me off and leave me with people that they had no business sending me off or leaving me with. And during that time, I was molested by three different men for over 2 years, and one of them ended up selling me to other men. And so between 5 and 7, I was a victim of human trafficking. And as a child, very, very young child. And that left me believing there was something inherently wrong with me. I must have been doing something, or these men wouldn't be picking me. There was something wrong with me, or they wouldn't be coming to me. They wouldn't be doing these things to me. And I didn't have language for this at the time. I didn't even know that it was called sexual molestation. I didn't know what sex was. I just knew that it didn't feel right. It certainly didn't feel good. And I felt very uncomfortable. And if it makes you feel uncomfortable hearing this part of my story, I truly apologize from the bottom of my heart. But it needs to be said. There's so many kids and so many young women that have experienced this. And so I won't go too deep in it, this isn't the time or the place for that, but it's what alcoholism contributed to in my household and my family. And there's a redemption part and a restoration part to that part of my story. So I'll bring it home before I leave you today. During that 2 years, it was a really hard period of my life. My parents' boss in a radio station, he was general manager of a radio station, he was a pretty powerful man, was one of my abusers. And it went on down to a teenage boy. And it was a friend of mine's brother. And then there was some creepy man that is like what you'd probably think of as a pedophile. So it kind of went through the whole gamut of the men that took their way with me. And after that, we ended up making another geographical relocation, and we moved to Baytown, and we were living in apartments. And I started acting out. At 7 years old, I ransacked my first house. I broke in and I destroyed it. I was seven, and I thought that I was a monster. And I lived that way, thinking that I was insane and I was a monster for decades to come. But what I now know is that I was a very normal little girl that was responding to very abnormal circumstances and things that had happened to her, experiencing trauma. So after ransacking my first house and getting caught, I was seven, I left some clues. I think one of them was leaving The Wizard of Oz on, because I was watching it while I did. That's my favorite movie, and it was next door to my girlfriend's house, so that was a genius mastermind, criminal mastermind at seven. I used to go and buy cartons of cigarettes from my mom at seven. That was apparently a thing you could do. And my mom would always be drunk, so she didn't know how many I actually brought home. You know, I'd open the carton for her because I was going to, you know, do this for her. But I really opened the carton so I could take a pack out because I started smoking at seven. And so at 7 years old, I'm ransacking houses. I'm smoking cigarettes. I'm having sex. I'm seven, and it's because a big part of it, my parents were so drunk so often that they had no clue, and they were so caught up in their disease that they had no clue, like none, that this stuff was going on. They caught the ransacking of the house, but they just thought, you know, I was some devil child and just needed a good spanking and, you know, grounding, and that'd take care of that. But what ended up happening would be I had my first bout with a psychosomatic illness at age seven. I was in the hospital with GI symptoms, and the doctors were trying to figure it out. They were trying to diagnose it, and my grandmother picked up on the fact that every time my father walked in the room, my stomach would, you could see physical knots well up in my stomach. And I was having a lot of other symptoms with it. They don't just usually hospitalize seven-year-olds without medical reason. And so when my grandmother picked up on that, she told the doctors, and they had pinpointed it and believed that it had to do with the fact that he would make eggs. And I didn't like them because they were runny, right? So I like my eggs. If anybody ever eats scrambled eggs with me, they're going to be burned. They're going to be brown on both sides, or I'm sending them back. I can't eat them. They'll gag. And so my dad would make me sit at the table from the morning until it was time to go to bed, until I ate those eggs. And if I didn't eat those eggs, I didn't leave that table, period. And so they thought it had to do with that. And so they told him to stop being so pressuring me so much with the eating stuff, and that didn't work. And I still had problems, and I've had problems my whole life with different illnesses and injuries and things like that. And I learned through working the steps that was one of the only times that I felt loved by my parents, because that was one of the only times that they would seek care for me. I remember my mother when I ran 104 fever carrying me and running across a parking lot with me into a doctor's office. It's the only time I remember my mother showing me that kind of love and devotion. So something in my brain connected, if I'm sick, I'll be loved. So when I was sick, I'd be loved. So I faked being sick a lot. And then I started lying. And I lied and I lied and I lied. Because if I lied and I got in trouble, I got their attention. If I lied and I got what I wanted, well, I got what I wanted. There really was no lose-win to that, or win. It was a win-win for me. I was getting at least someone to look at me because I felt so invisible. I was their babysitter now. My brother was born when I was 7. In fact, that hospital stay, I was on one floor and he was being born on the other floor. And so I became the built-in babysitter while they would go out and spend their days on the golf course drinking and their nights hosting parties, having me tend bar at 8 or 9. I'd be making the drinks and serving the drinks, and they thought it was cute, and I was always allowed to drink at least one, but I usually drank 2 or 3. I remember as their diseases progressed that the lights would get cut off. My dad had a gambling problem, and we were always in beer joints. The Radigo and Morrell's in Baytown were two of my dad's favorite places to go, and I remember getting in so much trouble because somebody had epoxied like a silver dollar on the bar or on the floor or something, and as an Al-Anon, I've found a way to get that thing up and take it home with me. And I got my rear end tore up for that. And then I remember meeting a friend at one of the beer joints, and her name was Jolene. And I remember, like all the other people in my life, her getting in the back of an El Camino and driving off, and I never saw her again. And I just went from one thing to another like that. There was no real friendships in my life. The girl that lived down the street, when we finally did settle down for a few years, the girl down the street, she had come over and she wanted to go home. And I didn't want her to go home. I didn't want her to ever leave. So I grabbed my father's shotgun and I held it on her. I was 10 years old, and I could have killed that young girl. But by the grace of God, I did not. But I remember that desperation, don't leave me. Don't leave me. Don't go home. And that's how I started with my control. And then I did that again late. I'd be 20-something years old, and I remember my husband, drunker and Cooter Brown, wanting to go out to the bar, getting ready, and he's already been drinking. And I can remember sitting there screaming at him, don't leave me, don't go, please don't go, please don't leave me. And then I grabbed our gun and I held it on him and demanded that he not walk out that door. I did crazy ass shit like that my whole life. And on one side, I thought it was completely normal and rational. And on the other side, in the moment, and on the other side, I knew I was absolutely off my rocker, out of my mind. So I would check myself into psychiatric hospitals. I would get in the psychiatric hospital, and then I would realize, like, I don't know, 15 minutes into it, oh my God, what have I done to myself? I don't belong here. I don't belong out there, but I don't belong in here. I don't know where I belong. And so then I would beg and plead, and I'd have to, you have to go before a board of doctors and nurses, and they have to deem you not a threat or a harm to yourself or others. Well, you've already convinced them, if you're in there, you've already convinced them you are a threat to yourself or others. So now I've got to convince them that I'm not a threat to myself or others. And this pattern, I would do that and check myself in and check myself out and check myself in and check myself out multiple times. I I know at least four times that I was an inpatient. I've been on antipsychotics, antidepressants. I have been to more therapist appointments than you shake a stick at. I had my first physical panic attack when I was 15 years old. I was finally had found a friend in my life that we were just thick as thieves and inseparable. And it was a guy, his name was Jeff, and we ran the streets and we got in trouble, and we probably, now that I know what I know, we were trauma bonding. He had all kinds of junk in his past, I had all kinds of junk in my past, and we were just meant to like be together. And but we were just friends. I had a crush on him, but he had a girlfriend, and so that wasn't gonna, you know, wasn't gonna be a thing. And and one night he met me up at the vault in Baytown, and that's where all the kids hung out, and we played video games and arcade games, that kind of thing. And he came up there, and it was like a scene from a movie. He told me he loved me, and we kissed, and it was like, well, the stars open. I'm 15, so it was like, I've got my man, you know, like he chose me. A man chose me. And the very next day, he shot himself, and he took his life. And once again, I felt abandoned. And once again, I thought, oh my God, nobody's going to love me. Nobody's going to want to be with me. And then I learned that the note that he left behind said that he did it because he loved me. And so then I got to carry that with me until I would do my step work and give it back to him. And know that it wasn't me. Know that it was a very troubled young man who had way more problems than this 15-year-old girl could have contributed to. But I'd carry that around with me, and it would color every decision I would make when it came to men from there on out. And that's why I would get desperate, and that's why I would beg and plead, and that's why abandonment to me equals sheer terror. Because I felt so utterly abandoned. My father, who slammed his fist down on the table and said, "That's my daughter," told me not long after that he would adopt me. And so they started allowing me to use his last name in preparation for the big adoption day, and their disease kind of got in the way of that. So finally the school said I couldn't use his last name any longer because it wasn't my legal last name, so they made me go back to that, to Fritch, and I had to learn how to deal with that as a child. And I kept asking my mom and dad, when are we gonna, you know, when am I gonna be adopted? And it didn't happen. And then my mom, when I was about 16, I had, at 15, I had gotten into a lot of trouble, as you've heard, and it just got way worse when I was a teenager. And so I moved out, I left home, and I went to live with a bass player in an 80s hair band, rock and roll band. And he wore the spandex and had the black, coal black dyed hair that was like frizzy and down to here, and wore the scarves around his head, his neck, his rear, like freaking scarves everywhere. And he was like my dream guy again. This is like right after Jeff. So I'm thinking, hey, this one wants me, so I'll go over here. And that's attractive right now. still can't really figure that one out. And so when I left there, and my dad didn't adopt me, and then my mom leaves my dad, and then she remarries my stepdad number two. My stepdad number two adopts my little brother, and I keep waiting for him to adopt me. I know I don't live in the house. I know that logically. I know I'm older. But here's what's going through my mind, my heart, and my thoughts. My brother has two legal fathers. He has two men that he has their last name. I've had three, and I had zero. That's a heavy, heavy weight to carry. To be rejected and abandoned by three different men. And that's the narrative that was in my head. My mother, when she told me about my sister, also told me that if abortions were legal, she would have aborted me. And I carried that around. It was through my step work that I realized that my mother, God bless her, she didn't have the language to tell me what that meant, and I didn't have the capacity to understand it. I took it as my mother wanted to kill me in the womb. What I learned through my step work was that my mother loved me very much. She wanted to do that. She wanted to give me up for adoption, but she didn't. She chose to keep me, and she chose to try to be my brownie leader. She only did it for a year, but she tried. She took me to tap and jazz, again, only for a few lessons, but she tried. She wouldn't have tried to do that stuff had she not loved me. I've learned a lot about trauma since I came into Al-Anon, and one of the things that I've learned is that actually abuse is not the worst thing that can happen to a child. Neglect is the worst thing that can happen to a child. Because with abuse, at least you make me angry enough to hurt you. With neglect, I give a crap less what happens to you. And that is more painful. And I felt a lot of neglect, and I felt a lot of abuse. But as I look back on it, I also understand this disease of alcoholism. I understand what my disease looks like when I'm in it, because I would repeat a lot of these patterns with my own children. I would do things that I said I was never going to do, and it just looked different with my kids than it did with my mom with me. And I'm sure with her, hers looked different too, because she wasn't standing over her child with a shotgun laughing maniacally and saying, I could have killed you in your sleep. And she wasn't stomping on my goldfish like her dad had done to her. So she really was doing the absolute best that she could in those moments with her disease and all the things that she had gone through. And I learned later that she was also a victim of sexual abuse. So when I would come to her and tell her intimate details about my first experience, and she reacted and you know, called me a whore and a slut and held me up against the door by my throat, I used to look back on that memory and think, oh my God, what a monster she was. But today I know how terrified she was. Today, and I don't make excuses for it. If she were here today, we would have this conversation. And she would have to own that part of hers, but I would also let her know that it doesn't have that power over me anymore. And I choose love. I choose to love her. I choose to understand that I didn't know everything she was going through at that time. I didn't know why she chose to do the things that she did, and I couldn't understand it because I didn't have the capacity to. But I pray to God that my children don't hold me to the same standard that I held my parents to. Because if they did, they would hate me till the day that I died. And I'm grateful today that that's not my story. When I finally survived my teenage years, I had moved to Maryland at 16. I had lived with bikers and just way more dysfunction and way more like shocking stories than we even remotely have time to recount tonight. But in Maryland, I was 16. I was living on the streets, sleeping on concrete as a homeless kid. And I finally got a job. I lied and taught myself how to be a collection agent. And lying came easy for me, and And getting people to do what I needed or wanted them to do came very easy for me because I learned from a very young age that's how you survive in my household, in my family of origin. So I was really good at it. And I became a collection agent, and then I was moved up to senior account specialist. I wasn't even 17 years old, and they thought I was an adult because that's what happens when you grow up in a household of alcoholism. You mature way faster than your years should allow you to. It was at that time that my boyfriend, who I had left Texas with, that I was just in love with, and y'all, I left the rock band bass player for the dope dealing biker, and that was a step up to me again. So I'm with the dope dealing biker, and I'm just in love head over heels, so much so that we're sleeping on the streets, and I'm cool with that. My head is going to sleep on cushions from a lawn chair on somebody's balcony on concrete in Glen Burnie, Maryland, in the projects of Glen Burnie, Maryland. And that's okay with me. That was one more instance of me choosing that hell over the hell of going back home. And I chose that one. And then he decides he's back home. He's going with his, you know, his old running buddies. And I decide I'm going to hook up with the owner of the collection agency's brother, who was my boss. And this guy had it all. He had a townhome and he had a nice car, and his brother owned the company, and I was 17 and I had arrived. And then I found out he's a intravenous coke addict. What? So I found it in our bathroom. And I threatened, and I said, you know, if you do this and you do that, I'll never be with you again, and I'll leave, and I'll do this. And that just went on and on for months. And I'd find it, and he would do that, you know, he would apologize. He's never going to do it again. He'd say what I needed him to say, and I'd stay. And then one night, we came home, and our home had been broken into, and we had a roommate, and he was actually selling cocaine. And this is a very affluent neighborhood. And he's selling cocaine, and his stash is stolen. And because of my super sleuthing, I figured out through a series of different things that it was my boyfriend that broke into our house that took his coke. And then I found the needle and the coke and everything, and aha, I have the evidence, and now I'm leaving. And as I do that, he proceeds to beat the living crap out of me. And he beat me to an absolute living pulp that night. And I called the police, and the police were not helpful. There was another couple I remember that was downstairs the entire beating. And I had already been through. I left my house because my father had started beating my mother and me severely. And I was once again, I was in that situation where I couldn't believe and didn't understand how on God's green earth I got here again. I jumped from my parents' house, where I had to literally pull a butcher knife on my father to stop him from killing my mother and I, to the rock playing bass player's crib, to the dope dealing biker, to the owner of the company's intravenous drug using coke addict. I didn't see the pattern there, but I kept picking so many men that had substance abuse disorders. I did it over and I did it over and I did it over, and I would continue to do it over and over and over again for the next 20 years. My husband was an alcoholic. My boyfriends were all alcoholics or addicts or both. And then in all of that, I would raise an alcoholic that would become an addict. And it was during that that season of my life that I was going out with some girlfriends one night. My kids were about 14 and 7-ish. And I was dating yet another alcoholic, and I told him I would meet him. He was the manager of a local club. club. And I told him I would meet him afterwards, but my girlfriends and I were going dancing. And this one particular girlfriend came from Katy to Clear Lake every weekend to go to Big Texas with us. I used to competitively country and western dance, fun fact about me. And so I used to go dancing all the time. I loved it, absolutely loved it. And that night, we decided we were going to go to Katy and go dancing in Katy so she didn't have to drive so far down here, just this one time. So we went to Midnight Rodeo, and I remember there was tons of men there, and there were tons of guys buying us shots and drinks and this, that, and the other. And I was like, well, I know I'm grateful I'm not driving. You are. And so I got in the car with a drunk driver, and it was about 5 minutes later that my life would change forever. My friend was making a curve at 35 miles an hour when she lost control, and the car rolled a few times. My neck was broken in three places. And I want you to look on your table, and I want you to see an object. Maybe it's the tissue box right there, or maybe it's the cup drink right there, or the tissue box over there. And I want you to try to move that box. Just take a second and try to move it with your mind. Because that's what it feels like to be paralyzed from the neck down. You're looking at your body. You're looking at your limbs. You're looking at your feet. You're looking at your boots. And you're telling them, stand up, push. What is going on? And you go from every single second of your life never being aware of how much effort and energy it actually takes to move your feet, to becoming acutely aware of nothing else but how much energy and effort it takes to move your feet. Like that. I was paralyzed from the neck down. I was a quadriplegic. I had broken my neck in three places. One of my vertebrae was crushed and replaced with a donor bone. Another vertebrae, fourth vertebrae, was subluxed. So your vertebrae hold your spinal cord. It goes through them, one after one after one. When it's subluxed, your vertebrae sit like this. A subluxation goes like this. So what does that do to a cord? It impinges it. So my spinal cord was impinged, and I had what's called an incomplete brown cord spinal cord injury. It's a very rare spinal cord injury. And at the level of my injury, which was C3 through C5, most people don't survive it. The majority of people that do survive it, they are quadriplegics for the rest of their lives. They're usually, almost always actually, on a breathing machine. It's the same, almost the same level as what Christopher Reeves had, Superman. And so that night they rushed me to the hospital and told me that I would likely not survive the night, that I probably would not survive the surgery. And they needed to bring me a phone to call anyone to say goodbye, that I needed to say goodbye to. And the first thing my friend said to me before the police arrived was, if they ask, I've only had two beers. And I remember sitting there, unable to move anything from my neck down, and thinking to myself, I just wanted to kill her. I wanted to rip her throat out in that moment. And what I now know today is that was me thinking of all the times all the alcoholics, all the addicts in my life had asked me to lie for them, had thrown their crap on me, and this was the last straw for me. So that night, I went into surgery. I did survive it. I'm here to tell you that, in case you didn't figure that one out. And then 2 years of intensive, absolute intensive physical and occupational therapy. I was able to get into a wheelchair and use a walker and later a cane. But the way that happened, I firmly believe, is very interesting. They told me I would never walk again. Well, the quickest way to get an Al-Anon to do something is tell them they can't do it and it won't happen. I promise you. So I found a way, and I'd love to say it was all me, and I'd like to take it, but my sponsor would probably tell me that's a lot of pride and ego. So I have to give credit to God, and I have to give credit to this program, because for the next 12 years, 11 and a half, I would be in a wheelchair, on a walker, or using a cane. And there's a couple of you in this room that were in those first meetings with me when I came in, and I was about 300 pounds, and I was on a walker, and I was in excruciating pain, physically and emotionally and certainly spiritually. And during that time, what got me here was from my accident for the next 10 years, about a year after my accident is when my son's addiction kicked in. And he would take my medication and he would say, "Mom, I'm going to help you give your meds today. Tell me what these are." And he would take these copious like notes on what these pills were and what they meant and what they did. And he would describe them. The little blue pill is for this, and the little, you know, square pill is for that, and the red one is for this. And then what I found out later is that that was his list that he used to sell my medication to at school. He had started dealing in high school. He had started using and dealing, and this would continue for the next 10 years of our lives. And he would be in and out and in and out and in and out of rehabs, of prison, of jails, of hospitals. I can remember one time him passing out in the driveway in his car and me going out and finding him unconscious. And I had already taken him multiple times to the ER. I had already taken him multiple times to rehab, and I had learned that they wouldn't tell me what his drug test results were if he wouldn't release it. So instead of taking my unconscious son to the emergency room, who had clearly overdosed on something, I took him down the road to a drug testing facility to pay for his drug testing so that I could get the results. And then I took him to an emergency room because I needed proof that he was using. He's unconscious in the car, in the driveway, but I needed to know he was using. That's how my mind worked. I could see it right in front of me, but I couldn't see what was right in front of me because I so desperately didn't want to believe it. And I knew that if he just argued with me enough, because I wanted to believe it, I wouldn't believe that he had been using. I would believe whatever cockamamie story he had come up with, because that's what I desperately wanted to believe. So we went through this, and we did that dance, and we pushed and we pulled, and we went back and forth and back and forth. And at one point, it was one of the last times that that he was in jail, and he wrote me a letter, and I thought, and I asked permission before I shared this, let me just say that. He wrote me a letter, and he talked about a friend of his. He said he was doing something, he was in a, he was reading the paper, and he said, "I heard some more news. I read in the paper, in the obituaries actually, another person that I know has passed away. His name was Bozo the Clown. And he passed away on St. Patrick's Day. He was 21 and was going to college. Well, I worked with him at a local restaurant. I didn't know he passed, but the last time I saw him, he was pilled out and had no idea where he was. And that was a year and a half ago. So I figured, it being St. Patty's Day and all, it had to be a drug or alcohol related. Well, I told my friend about it when he came to visit, and he actually knew what had happened, and it's really sad what took place. Bozo the Clown had went to a party and being thrown by a girl named so-and-so. It was quite a few people there getting messed up, and Bozo had liquid morphine. Well, he ended up taking too much and nodded off and passed away, overdosing. Well, that's sad, but that's not the saddest. No one knew he was dead at the party, so they just thought he was in a deep sleep from partying, and they thought it would be funny, since he was asleep, to take permanent marker and draw all over his body. So they drew body parts all over him, and they wrote gay remarks on him, and this was all while he was dead. And they woke up the next morning and saw he wasn't waking up, so they called 911 and announced that he was dead. His family saw his body with all the drawings on him. It sucks. That makes two people I know since I've been in here that are dead from drugs or alcohol. And I'm actually really glad I came here and I went through this, because it's been an eye-opener for the experience and the knowledge that I have gained here that I couldn't have gotten anywhere else. And I will definitely use it when I get out. That kid has me thinking that the last moment of his life that people will remember is him being messed up on morphine and drawing of private parts on him. And that's just not the way I want to be remembered. I will make sure I leave a legacy behind. People will remember my name for generations to come. I will be a role model. I promise that. My life will definitely change once I get out. I would love to tell you that that was true. And for him, he would tell you that was true for him. In that moment, on that day, like every other moment, like every other day of my child's life, he doesn't wake up and want to be an alcoholic. He doesn't wake up and want to be an addict. He doesn't wake up and think, today, I want to overdose and have all my buddies draw private parts and ugly names on my body. He wakes up thinking, today I will be okay. Today will be the first day of the rest of my life, and I will make a difference for generations to come. And I am here to tell you that that kid is making a difference for generations to come, because he changed my life. I thought it was him that got me in these rooms. It was his disease that got me to the point of the end of me. I was at complete and utter devastation. A year after this was written was the worst year of my life. And it was at the end of this year that I came through the doors of Al-Anon, ready to commit suicide on my own. I had not one friend. I had not one family member left. My mother and my father died from cirrhosis of the liver. My brother is a missing person. My sister OD'd. So I had lost my entire family in a 2-year period. And I was living with the spinal cord injury and all that that entailed. And it was through all of those series of events that I came walking through that door 6 years ago this month. And 6 years ago this month, my life was profoundly changed. And I walked up here tonight more nervous than I was that night that I walked through those doors. And I'm leaving here tonight feeling more love than I'd ever felt in my life. Because when I look out, I look at faces of people that know me and love me and choose to be in relationship with me today. I know safe men today because of this program. I have friends with women that I would have never been able to be in relationship with today, because of this program. I have a new career because of this program. My son has been at the same job now for 4.5 years. He has had his own place for 4.5 years. He had saved up for his own car and had his own car. He earned his driver's license back. He did all this when I thought it was just completely impossible, because he was a felon, a 2-time felon. But he worked it out and he figured it out, and God stepped in and he stepped up. And so I share all of this with you today. I have a few things up here, and I was going to go through them because it reminds me of what this program's given me. I did scrapbooks. I've been doing scrapbooks over what Al-Anon has given back to me. And in these scrapbooks, there's magazine stories. There's seminars I've attended. There's groups that I've led. There are things that I've done that I would have never done. And so for tonight, if you take nothing home, take this home. If my life can be restored, if I can find a happy, joyous, and free road out of the hell I was living in, it is entirely possible for you too. But to get what I've got, you've got to do what I did. And that is work this program. That is get a sponsor. That is work through those steps, 1 through 12, not on your own, but with another in the fellowship. And just show up. Keep coming back. Because it does make a difference, and it will change your life for the better. So I want to ask, who has the shortest time in the program? Anybody less than 90 days? Right there. Okay, anybody less than 60 days? Anybody less than 30 days? All right. So let's do, how many days you guys got?
About 40.
You got 40? How about over here?
I can't
come
in August. I'm not sure of the
day. Okay. You do the math, because I'm like freaking out up here in front of everybody, and that's not going to work for me. We'll get back to you. How many days have you been here? It's what? 60. So have you been here more than 40?
Definitely not.
Definitely not. Not more than 40, right?
Like I said, sometime in
August. Okay, fantastic. Yeah, I'm telling you, I can't think right now. So I am a photographer, and because of this program, I am a photographer. And because of this program, this year I went to Europe and celebrated my 50th birthday. And I took this picture of Triberg, Germany, of a waterfall, and I want you to have it. Because I hope that on your worst day, you can look at it and go, it can get better. Because it really can. Keep coming back. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Kelly. Can we do the short version of the closing, which is who you see here, what you hear here, let it stay here.
Here.
Everybody, let's circle up. Mark, welcome back. Can you lead us out, please?
Oh, sure. Who's the host with the most?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever
and ever. Amen. Keep coming back. It works if you work it.
I'm going to go find something.
I'm going to go find something.